So good afternoon. The first thing I want to say is that I think that I'm going to be the Debbie Downer of the conversation, the panel, a little bit more than the others. Possibly because it's just I haven't thought through what the positive upside of or the response is to some of the things that I'm going to say. The other thing I should say is that I actually don't have that disclosure slide, but I will say that that I also have nothing to disclose, and it's on the conference website. You can definitely see that. Okay, there we go. All right, good. So one of the things that started to concern me about the public conversation about public health law was the tone and the nature of the arguments that were made during the debates about the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. So I'm just sort of going all the way back to that moment in time. And, we all know what the, purported goals of the statute are. And one of the things that was disturbing at the time and continues to be, I think, a problem in the discourse today, is the assertion constantly that the Affordable Care Act is very unpopular with the public. This is I'm sort of echoing something, building off of what Scott talked about. And that's obviously, everyone in this room knows that this is a vast oversimplification of what the public opinion polls really do say, that people, it is true, are not in favor of being made to do something that they don't want to do, generally speaking, but are in favor of a lot of other provisions of the statute, the insurance market reforms, guaranteed issue, underwriting on the basis of pre-existing health status, all those sorts of things are very popular with the public. And even if one is to watch the news hour, which, is said to be the mouthpiece for these, liberal ideas, I watched one entire Weekend Review Friday telecast where every single person on Gwen Ifill's panel recited the mantra, the act is very unpopular, but, this is what's going on now. And that was just wrong and oversimplified, but it feeds into, the sort of public getting onto this bandwagon about the unpopularity of the statute. But what about, besides the polling and the lack of precision in discussing the polls, what have the responses to the statute been? They've emphasized that, the interference with liberty. They've emphasized, exceeding Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, not a valid exercise of Congress's taxing power, and a reverence for the role of the states, operation of the democratic process. All very abstract, non-concrete ideas that do not, really sort of deal in a very tactile way with what the statute was trying to accomplish and what the implications of not doing something might be. Just sort of abstract ideas about the Constitution and the nature of the democracy and the role of various actors within it. And so it leads to, and don't worry, I'm not totally without humor. So this was an editorial cartoon in the Boston Globe last week where, obviously commenting on, the whole dust up over a lot of individual plans being canceled around the country. How dare you trade his gruel for a three-course meal? And this cartoon reminds me that I've always wondered about how the rhetoric in arguing against the Affordable Care Act made having health insurance sound like a bad idea. This was an illegitimate enterprise to try to get more, make insurance more accessible to larger groups of people and by extension to give them greater access to healthcare. This cartoon exemplifies that idea. So why did that happen? Because of the ability of the rhetoric to focus on some of these abstractions. So if you look at John Roberts' opinion in the case, the Chief Justice's opinion, he talks about the federal government as one of enumerated powers which presupposes some limitations and, it's possible for Congress to run up against those limitations that state sovereignty is not an end in itself, but protection for the liberties of citizens by diffusing state power among different levels of sovereigns. And then finally, the originalism argument that the framers of the Constitution did not envision a society, this is a direct quote, in which Congress could compel citizens to act in a way that would be good for them or for society. It's just not consistent with this very abstract idea of what the framers thought, even if we could know that. My husband is fond of saying that one of the reasons the framers had no idea about the Affordable Care Act is because healthcare could hardly do anything for you in 1789. And so going back to their idea of what Congress should be able to accomplish in this area seems a little silly. So because of the abstraction, there was the absence of any weight given to these public problems the ACA was designed to address. In the case, more abstractions, the Roberts opinion, a country in which the government can require the purchase of a product is not the country the framers of our Constitution envisioned. And in the joint opinion written by the Scalia, Kennedy, Alito, and Thomas group that, said that if every person comes within the commerce power of Congress to regulate by the simple reason that he will one day engage in commerce, the idea of limited government power as an event. It's all about abstraction and not what is happening in real people's lives. And I know, by the way, this emphasizes Scott's point that a lot of these challenges come from the regulated industry, the people and the business entities that object. So what about these ideas? Dahlia Lithwick published a piece at the time, right after the oral arguments, which concluded with this comment. This case isn't so much about freedom from government-mandated broccoli or gyms. It's about freedom from our obligations to one another, freedom from the modern world in which we live. It's about the freedom to ignore the injured, walk away from those in peril, to never pick up the phone or eat food that's been inspected. Sometimes to get some of this, you had to have listened to the oral arguments in detail. It's about the freedom to be left alone. And now we know the court is worried about freedom, the freedom to live like it's 1804. And so instead of embracing what modern government, modern science, and modern economics has taught us, it's about, these ideologies as opposed to pragmatism. These are just further illustrations of how her comment is borne out in the part of the court's opinion about the Medicaid expansion, the spending power rests on some abstract notion of contract between the state and the federal government, and we don't want to undermine the status of the states as independent sovereigns while ignoring the public health interests of the population. Talking about how, the idea of the Medicaid expansion is really about changing the notion that government programs are only about helping the neediest among us and not about establishing some sort of, comprehensive national response to a big public health problem, which is the lack of health insurance. The joint opinion also goes down this path, speculating that, a state forced out of the program by the original structure of the Medicaid expansion would lose a huge sum of money and might find it necessary to increase its own healthcare expenditures substantially, not recognizing that they could avoid that choice by taking the Medicaid expansion and therefore increasing state taxes. But not saying and going a step further saying that there could be a political response within the state to that. Also ignoring that millions would be left uninsured by the failure of the states, many states, to adopt the Medicaid expansion, as the Supreme Court, now made it easier for them to do. So, and then, you know, again, the joint opinion goes on to talk about, you know, the ability of Congress to invade the state's jurisdiction by allowing this exercise of the spending clause this way. Well, it all reminds me of something that Wendy Parmet wrote in her book about, in a way, returning to ideas that predominated in the 1930s and the early part of the 20th century. The narrow definition of statutes and what their range of action might be thought to be, and a failure to consider economic evidence about healthcare markets and the real impact of the statute. And I apologize for the typo in the next bullet, that repeated language. But you know, as in you know, the court failed to see these issues in the Affordable Care Act decision, and did not, just as it did in the Lochner case, not consider that baking was a dangerous occupation. After all, everybody's mom bakes in the kitchen, and saw only occupational health laws as benefiting only a single population, not the public in general. This law, the Affordable Care Act, was benefiting only the people who were uninsured and not the rest of us. And there are other examples, which I won't go into as much detail, where this has come up. The preemption doctrine, which I'll talk about three examples. The preemption doctrine, and this through one illustrative case, abortion regulations, although not in great detail because of the scope and range of a lot of things the states are doing right now, and the Affordable Care Act and the coverage for contraception. But we could go on and on with examples, the gun laws, all kinds of things. Okay, so what about the preemption doctrine? So in this case, again, we have industry, the regulated industry, as the objector to the regulation. And this is a state regulation that California adopted prohibiting the use of animals that couldn't walk as they entered the slaughterhouse. And it was a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court saying that California's effort to screen those animals out of the food supply was preempted by the Federal Meat Inspection Act. And I think that probably on the law and preemption doctrine, the court was absolutely correct in that decision. The preemption provision is expansive, but the court in its opinion, perhaps in a subtle signal, did not criticize the congressional choice to preempt stronger state laws that might lead to greater safety in the food supply, but gave it instead a very detailed discussion of the condition of the animals arriving at the slaughterhouses and how animals that we would all consider probably sick and inappropriate for entering the food supply were allowed nonetheless to be slaughtered and passed through the processing with perhaps, if the meat inspector decided, a delay on the meat coming from that animal until further tests were done. But there was no absolute keeping those animals out of the screening process. So from that decision, that even from that case, you know, the court is really not giving an expansive role to the states, sort of in this context. It concluded that states are not free to decide which animals are suitable to enter the food chain. And we see this, the preemption doctrine operating a lot of in different areas. The recent decision about generic drugs and tort liability, you know, in other contexts, preemption doctrine is operating against the ability of states to engage in experimentation about public health regulatory measures, and we're left, as we were in the days of Lochner, to the benevolence of the corporate entities. And so we can all read the newspapers about what's happening with abortion regulations adopted by the states, and here the states are asserting a public health justification for some of these measures, going against trends in almost every other area of practice to devolve procedures and treatments to lower levels of healthcare professionals, not, you know, away from MDs to other kinds of health professionals, to get treatments out of hospital facilities, and so forth. And this is also, you know, sort of identifying, you know, that, you know, where public health is really masquerading as an excuse to regulate other things. And then the Massachusetts case is the buffer zone thing, which is the transition to the next topic, which is about the First Amendment and the court's decisions in the First Amendment cases that relate to this area or upcoming court decisions. So as we all know, through a whole series of regulatory decisions, coverage for contraception is included as an essential preventive benefit under the Affordable Care Act. And the government has created an exception for religious organizations that meet the traditional qualifications as a religious organization. Then there was the gray area of organizations that have a religious connection, like universities, hospitals, but are not the religious organization themselves, which the government created an accommodation for. But then there are whole categories of for-profit organizations that are trying to say that because the owners of these companies have objections to, you know, the coverage of contraception, that they should be exempt too, and that this requirement violates their rights, the rights of the corporation under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There are these two cases that I have highlighted here, the Conestoga Woods Specialties Corporation case and the Hobby Lobby Stores case. I have both petitions for cert pending before the Supreme Court. There's a conflict in the circuits. The Third Circuit upheld the requirement, and the Tenth Circuit has said that it violates the RFRA statute. And so I think it would be very surprising if the Supreme Court did not decide to take on this issue. And so we'll get to see what the reach of the Citizens United decision has been. I don't know if you've seen this, and I don't know if you can read in the back what the caption is, but we have someone presenting to presumably the nine justices of the court. If you prick a corporation, does it not bleed? If you tickle it, does it not laugh? If you poison it, does it not die? And so we will get to see how far the Supreme Court will go with the Citizens United case. So in conclusion, I would say that that these are the risks that I see spelled out really quite clearly in some of these in these cases, particularly around the National Federation of Independent Business case. The challenge for us as public health lawyers and public health professionals is to try to demonstrate the public health role of regulation that has been characterized as pure economic regulation and how important that is for courts and legislatures to consider, that we have to really develop a doctrine to differentiate corporations from natural persons in this respect, that it's one thing for the court to decide that corporations have an ability to contribute like a person to campaign committees, but it'll be interesting to see how we can decide that a corporation has religious beliefs and whether we can look past the corporate form to the owners of the corporation, the shareholders, to reach that conclusion. And because what's lost there, obviously, are the many thousands of employees of these corporations around the country who don't really get to choose their employer and who will therefore not benefit from, you know, an important provision of the Affordable Care Act if the decision goes the other way. And then finally, you know, really trying to identify measures masquerading as public health laws and to try to present the public health arguments so that they can be overturned and not enforced to the detriment of public health. So thank you.